This is Law and Disorder. Today on Law and Disorder, we're going to have a special update from two of our own who tried to go and actually did go to the inauguration.
We'll hear an excerpt from a speech by Chris Hedges at Stop the Israeli Massacre in Gaza.
Chris is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, a former New York Times Mideast bureau chief, and a really respected expert on the current situation in Gaza, Israel, and Palestine.
We'll also hear from attorney Abdin Jabara about the recent atrocities in Palestine.
Abdin's story is chilling. It tells how the world looked away as Israel destroyed Gaza, sadly, possibly meeting one of its goals to continually divide and destroy the Palestinian people.
Please stay with us. Michael, last week or the week before, you gave us an update on the closing of Guantanamo and some of the center's continuing work. What are your thoughts now? We have a new president, CCR cases.
Our new president, Barack Obama, signed a number of executive orders. There were actually executive orders that we at the Center for Constitutional Rights and others have been pushing for in the first 100 days campaign. The first one, and the most important to me personally, of course, as well as to our clients at Guantanamo, was the executive order that Obama signed to close Guantanamo within 1 year. A good, important order. Now, while the center wanted it closed more quickly and the center put out its own plan for closing it in 3 months, it's still a remarkable, remarkable start. What the order says, and this is also very important, its positive parts are that within 1 year, Guantanamo is to be closed, that people are to be tried in federal courts, if they're to be tried, or they're to be repatriated to their home countries or countries where they can go safely. That's the crucial crux of the order. That's the crucial part. That's the part that we really care about. Unfortunately, in this order, there are a couple of what I refer to as trap doors, which are some dangers that lurk behind what appears to be a very positive order. The dangers are really two, other than the year. The two are, there is a hole or opening for cases that might not be able to be tried in a federal court. I don't think that will be used, but there is a study commission and a commission that's going to look at the cases to say, can we try these people in federal court? There's only a handful of people we're talking about. Or do we have to try them in a court-martial, or worse, do we have to try them in some kind of enhanced military commission? I don't think we're going to come to that. I think Obama's getting enough positive feedback on this that to the extent there's trials, they will all be in federal court. But it's just a warning that there's still a hole in that executive order. The second hole in the executive order concerns something that I've been railing against for a long time, and in which there's, sad to say, now two camps, some liberals even on the wrong side of this, and that's the question of, let's say you can't try people according to these people, and let's say you can't send them back to their home country or another country that can safely take them, but they're too dangerous to let go, and you, for some reason, you can't try them. I'm not sure there's anybody like that. I doubt there's anybody like that, but these people are putting out the possibility of then holding people under a preventive detention scheme. The order doesn't say anything about that, but it again leaves open the question, after study, if there's people that somehow don't fit the two basic baskets here, which is the trial basket or the release to their country or another country basket, then what happens to those people? Hopefully this was just put in there as a facial safety valve. So it looks like there, if there are such people, that they can still be held. My guess is there won't be any, and my guess is there won't be a preventive detention scheme set up. On the other hand, as I say these words to you, there's a real push going on with people who don't like the fact that Guantanamo's closing, and some who, as I said, liberals who are trying to push their own version of a preventive detention scheme that will supposedly make us safer. Of course, it'll do nothing of the sort. It'll bring down on our heads every bit of condemnation that we've already gotten for Guantanamo, and will set up a scheme of preventive detention that will be not just used against a few people at Guantanamo, but ultimately against American citizens in the next crisis. So as we applaud Obama for this. We still have to make sure that his feet are held to the fire, that Guantanamo's closed, people are tried or released, and that we have no preventive detention scheme and no trials outside of federal courts. That's executive order number one. Executive order number two is the order concerning how you're permitted or what the legal limits are of interrogating detainees picked up. And I won't any longer say in the so-called global war on terror, because to his credit, Obama has not mentioned a global war on terror. He talks about a fight against, you know, certain kinds of people who might want to hurt America, but he does not talk about a global war on terror. In any case, the second order concerns interrogation. It does what we at the center and many others have been demanding. It applies the Army field techniques of interrogation to not just the Army, which is where they currently apply, but to every agency of the United States that holds detainees. Primarily, we're talking about the CIA. The CIA asked to be exempted from the interrogation techniques in the Army Field Manual, feeling they were too mild, that they wouldn't really be able to get information from people. The claim was, of course, it's a complete BS claim, but that's the claim. They claim they wanted to still use enhanced interrogation techniques. Obama said no and applied the Army Field Manual techniques across the board to every detainee. Now, there's two issues, again, we have to look at on this interrogation issue. One is there's some people who legitimately feel that the Army Field Manual techniques go too far. And there is an appendix in them that allows for isolation for up to 30 days. And there's no doubt that goes too far. That can destroy a personality. So it's not that we're so excited and happy about the Army Field Manual, but it's certainly much better than torture, waterboarding, and enhanced interrogation techniques. So that's one issue. The second issue is, again, there's what I call a trapdoor in this interrogation prohibition or its interrogation executive order, and that is there's going to be another study commission set up with, I think, members of the CIA and others, and they're going to decide whether there need to be other techniques that the CIA has to use. Arguably, they will at least claim that those fit within the law, but who knows? Again, that would be extremely, extremely dangerous if that ever happened, that the CIA was given extra interrogation techniques outside of what the Army could use. So again, there's two things to look for here. One is the Army Field Manual being a little broader than a lot of us civil libertarians would like. And the second, of course, is the trapdoor loophole for the CIA, which, again, I want to emphasize, has not been used yet, may never be used, but there is a grouping set up to see whether it needs to be used. Because of the claim by the CIA, they may not be able to work with the Army Field Manual techniques. We'll go to number three. It's not really a separate executive order, but within the interrogation executive order, there's also a remarkable, utterly remarkable statement that closes every CIA secret site around the world. So that's the end of secret sites. Closed, shuttered, gone, end of it. Very, very important. That means that the site that the U.S. once had in Poland, the one in Morocco, the one in Thailand, the ones wherever they are today, which Bush has kept open, are no longer as of the signing of that order. Absolutely crucial, a terrific order, but again, a trapdoor. Again, it says this study commission will look and see whether the CIA still needs to use in the future any secret sites because the CIA wants to. Again, I think it's unlikely that will happen. Very unlikely, but again, it's a worry for us. Another very important decision Obama made on his first full day in office was with regard to the OLC, Office of Legal Counsel, memos. Those, you recall, are the infamous memos, the ones that allow torture, the ones that say waterboarding isn't torture, the ones that say the president can torture in the name of national security. Those are the John Yoo memos and all of those. And the president said that every single one of those memos was null and void. No good anymore, can't be used anymore, gone. So they're going to be writing some new memos, which is a very, very positive development. So all in all, for people at Guantanamo, for people who might have been taken to secret sites, for people who might still have faced the potential of waterboarding, it was a very, very, very good week. As Yogi Berra said, it's not over till it's over. And we'll see what happens and whether we're really able to close Guantanamo without having it repackaged in this country into some kind of preventive detention scheme. And so it's a major vindication. But let me just say, our attorneys are still in Guantanamo. There's still a hunger strike going on of 41 people. There's still, at least as far as we last heard, force feeding of those people, which we think amounts to torture. So it's not over. But we're certainly taking a major, major step in the right direction. We're speaking a day after the inauguration, and our co-host, Heidi Boghossian, was there and wants to talk about what her experience was. And she was with another National Lawyers Guild board member, Dan Greger, who also will talk about what it was like to get on a bus and go to the inauguration. So, Dan, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
How'd you get there? What'd you do? When I heard you were going, I said, are you out of your minds? Get on a midnight bus? I said, I'm too old to get on a midnight bus.
Well, I had some of those thoughts, too, but then I realized it's once in a lifetime.
And you realized you're younger than I am.
Not too much, but we were offered tickets to sit in the bleachers at the parade part of the whole event. The bleachers had been freed up, as we've reported before on Law and Disorder, freed up to the general public, many seats added compared to the last two inaugurations, which were basically controlled by the Bush administration and mostly lit in Republicans only. Thanks to litigation brought by Mara Verheiden Hilliard and Carl Massinio, both of the National Lawyers Guild and the public law interest firm of Partnership for Civil Justice in D.C. So with that invitation, who could pass up a chance to be really in with the people on streets that had been freed up for the people by litigation by guild members? So Dan and I, we were going to get on a quarter of 2 a.m. bus. But then we realized that the traffic as you enter D.C. might be held up for an hour or two. So we got on the bus at quarter of midnight and got in at 4 a.m. But the bus ride, Dan, was to me one of the highlights of the trip.
It went smooth compared to many other things logistically, yes.
But, how long did the bus take you, Dan?
Only about 4.5 hours going down, about what it should have getting down.
And tell me, was it full?
I believe it was. I think it was full.
Everybody going down to the inauguration,
correct.
I assume.
Okay, but aside from those logistics, we had the best driver ever named English. And she got on and people cheered. She said, we're going to D.C. And I think really, as I remember it, about 90% of the bus were African-American women. And boy, was the energy exciting and enthusiastic. We really felt like we're on a trip on a bus to D.C. to make history. So when we got there, we walked in the dark. It was 4 a.m., freezing cold. We had some coffee at the bus train station, and then at 5 o'clock, we headed with the masses through really a trek that I'll never forget. We walked under the 3rd Street tunnel, and there were hundreds of people walking through the tunnel to get to one of the checkpoints because we were going to wait early in line to get into the parade route. Already, there were thousands of people in the dark. It was surreal. And as Dan commented, as someone who is pro-environment and alternative transportation, that...
Yes, what did Dan comment?
That there was something beautiful about seeing, I think it's Interstate 395 at that point, and seeing it full of pedestrians rather than cars.
Yeah. With, of course, police vehicles storming by and full sirens and lights.
So I'm assuming both of you guys got to the mall and saw the inauguration?
Well, actually, we didn't. We had to make it to a checkpoint to wait all day to get into the parade route. So,
so you never got to the inauguration?
Well, no, and we knew we wouldn't because you either had to be at the inauguration or get ready for the parade. So there were sort of two distinct groups.
But what happened to your seat in the bleachers?
Oh, our seats were there. It's just getting in there turned out to be less orderly than we thought. So Dan and I got separated at about 8 a.m. after waiting in line. I was so cold I had to go get a cup of coffee. And then I come out and I see everyone rushing to the checkpoint in this unorderly crowd of thousands. And that's when we got lost.
And I was in that unorderly crowd of thousands. The logistics and how they were announcing things and where people were told to go was never quite clear. And so it really ended up just being a scrum rushing. Anywhere you saw somebody rushing, you followed them and rushed. So we were able to see and hear some of the things that were going on with the inaugural events. There was good energy. There were huge crowds. The mall was wall-to-wall people with energy.
So you got onto the mall. That's good. Okay.
Oh, absolutely.
But I want to talk about my lovely experience because after I lost Dan getting a cup of coffee inside this food mart where you had to wait in long lines to go through metal detectors to get warm and to get something to drink or eat, I made friends with some women in line, and we ended up sharing a table and running into another group of people, and they were from Brooklyn. And I just wanted to mention, because we had such a lovely time together, one of the women teaches sociology at Meckers Evers CUNY School, and she had actually gone there because one of her students was with her, who turned out to be a former community activist who's working against an effort that Bloomberg is pushing through to move one of the largest homeless shelters out of Manhattan to make way for a development and into Brooklyn. So we talked about a lot of things. We shared a blanket. We shared a chair because there were thousands of people inside waiting to watch the proceedings on the screen. And we really had a lovely 2 hours together with about, there must have been seven of us. And the feeling of camaraderie with utter strangers was what, for me, made this a really special day. I really began to feel, and then when I got to the bleachers, Dan is correct, we could not absolutely get to the north side. So I sat in bleachers on the south side. People were dancing in the bleachers, even hours before the parade came by us, dancing, singing. They had an announcer. They were playing music. I looked around and I saw faces that surely would never have been there under the Bush administration, limited bleachers. And it was just so moving. But the feeling that you could talk to anyone, you were in this together, that this was history, that things are never going to go back to the way they have been, was so moving and profoundly, personally rewarding and special. I'm so glad that I went. Then on the bus back, which took me hours to get out of the area because they really would not let you. They closed the subway down. You could not get out. You were literally trapped inside until about 6 o'clock. I just made it to the 6:30 bus, sat next to a man who was there from Ghana. He'd been visiting one of his daughters in New York and had to be there to experience it. And it was just everyone you talked to had a common bond. We were there because we wanted to see this historic moment.
Now, Dan, you had a slightly more eventful trip coming home. Is that right?
I did. Well, and I'd actually back up. Our common bond of the folks that I ended up spending several hours inside Union Station with was of common stories of their tickets into the inauguration and into the bleachers, not actually getting them in.
Right.
Different colors of tickets, blue and gold and red. And people saying, oh, you didn't get in on your blue? Well, we didn't get in on yellow either.
I assume that's the case. This is one of the reasons that I hesitated to go.
And I will try to stick to facts. There was enormous great energy even in Union Station. They did essentially lock us all into Union Station, the police did. They shut down all of the exits except for the First Street exit across from the Postal Museum. I don't think I'm exaggerating if I guess that there were tens of thousands of people inside Union Station with one set of exits. That
listeners ought to know, you know, that Dan is from one of the most uncrowded states in the country, Alaska. And so having more than three or four people in the room, he gets a little nervous.
Yeah, true. Although I grew up in cities and went to law school in Boston. But that, yeah, so thousands of people all trying to get out. They shut down the metro, at least the red line, and they shut down most of the metro lines during the parade. And that was one problem, is that people were trying to get out of Union Station, but also trying to get into the red line. And it then took about an hour and a half to get from the exit doors on that First Street exit plaza side, maybe 50 yards to where you get to First Street near the Red Line entrance, complete with various stripes of police screaming at us on megaphones to move, 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 go, go, go. People's energy stayed good and their attitude stayed good, but there literally was nowhere to go. There was nowhere you could move to.
What happened on your bus?
Well, then I did get to the Greyhound, and I will say this for Greyhound and the various bus lines, it was probably the best organized logistics of the inauguration, in my experience, was the Greyhound. Got on the bus, had another fantastic bus driver, and we made great time until we got to between exits 2 and 3 on the New Jersey Turnpike, came to a full stop, and moved over the space of the next about 2 hours or so, we moved maybe a quarter of a mile.
Oh, my gosh.
Apparently, or at least as it was reported to us, there had been a bomb threat made on the southbound side of the turnpike, so they shut down both sides. Nobody could go anywhere. I actually left an hour and a half before Heidi. I didn't get back into New York City until a couple of hours later after Heidi got back.
So what time was that?
I got back to Port Authority at about 1 a.m. or so.
Wow, so neither of you guys have had a lot of sleep.
But boy, was it worth it.
Well, I think even Dan thinks it was worth it.
It was worth it as an experience. I don't know that I'd want to repeat it again anytime soon, but I'm glad I went. And yeah, the energy and the camaraderie and being with all those people who felt so passionately was really great.
We go now to hear an excerpt from a speech by Chris Hedges, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and former New York Times Mideast bureau chief. Chris was speaking at Stop the Israeli Massacre in Gaza, an event held by the New York Society for Ethical Culture a couple of weeks ago in New York. Let's have a listen.
The incursion and bombardment of Gaza is not about destroying Hamas. It is not about stopping rocket fire into Israel. It is not about achieving peace. The Israeli decision to rain death and destruction on Gaza, to use lethal weapons of the modern battlefield on a largely defenseless civilian population, is the final phase in the decades-long campaign to ethnically cleanse Palestinians. The assault on Gaza is about creating squalid, lawless, and impoverished ghettos in the West Bank and Gaza, where life for Palestinians will be barely sustainable. It is about building a series of ringed Palestinian enclaves where the Israeli military will have the ability to instantly shut off movement, food, medicine, and goods to perpetuate the misery. Privilege and power, especially military power, is a dangerous narcotic. Violence destroys those who bear the brunt of its force, but also those who try to use it to become gods. Ehud Barak, Israel's defense minister, said Israel is engaged in a war to the bitter end against Hamas in Gaza. A war? Israel uses sophisticated attack jets and naval vessels to bomb densely crowded refugee camps, schools, apartment blocks, mosques, and slums, to attack a population that has no air force, no air defense, no navy, no heavy weapons, no artillery units, no mechanized armor, no command and control, no army, and calls it a war. It is not a war. It is murder. The images of dead Palestinian children lined up as if asleep on the floor of the main hospital in Gaza are a metaphor for the future. Israel will, from now on, speak to the Palestinians in the language of death, and the language of death is all the Palestinians will be permitted to speak back. The use of terror and hunger to break a hostile population is one of the oldest forms of warfare. I watched the Bosnian Serbs employ the same tactic when I was in Sarajevo. And I also watched the Bosnian Serbs, like the Israelis, attempt to justify their systematic destruction of the city with thousands of dead and wounded on a few paltry Muslim mortars and light arms fire. Those who orchestrate such sieges do not grasp the terrible rage born of long humiliation, indiscriminate violence, and abuse. A father or a mother whose child dies because of a lack of vaccines or proper medical care does not forget. A boy whose ill grandmother dies while being detained at an Israeli checkpoint does not forget. Families who carry the broken bodies of their children to hospitals do not forget. All who endure humiliation, abuse, and the murder of those they love do not forget. Is it any wonder that 71% of children interviewed at a school in Gaza recently said they wanted to be a martyr? Militant movements feed off of martyrs, and Israel is delivering the maimed and the dead by the truckload. Hamas fighters, armed with little more than light weapons, a few rockets, small mortars, are battling one of the most sophisticated military machines on the planet. And the determined resistance by these doomed fighters exposes throughout the Arab world the gutlessness of dictators like Egypt's Hosni Mubarak. Who refuses to open Egypt's common border with Gaza despite the slaughter. Israel, when it bombed Lebanon 2 years ago, sought to destroy Hezbollah. By the time it withdrew, humiliated, it had swelled Hezbollah's power base and handed it heroic status throughout the Arab world. And Israel is doing the same for groups like Hamas. The refusal by our political leaders, from Barack Obama to all but five members of Congress, to the major media, to speak out in defense of the rule of law and fundamental human rights, exposes our cowardice and our hypocrisy. Those who openly condemn the Israeli crimes, including Israelis such as Yuri Avneri, Tom Segov, Ilan Pape, Gideon Levy, Amira Haas, as well as American stalwarts, Noam Chomsky, Dennis Kucinich, Norman Finkelstein, and Richard Falk, are ignored or spurned like lepers. They are denied a platform in the press. They are rendered nearly voiceless. We have become monsters, militarized bullies, heartless and savage. We are a party to human slaughter, a flagrant war crime, and do nothing. We forget that the innocents who suffer and die in Gaza are a reflection of ourselves, of how we might have been should fate and time and geography have made the circumstances of our birth different. We forget that we are all absurd and vulnerable creatures. We all have the capacity to fear and hate and love. This blind defense of Israeli brutality towards the Palestinians is a betrayal of the memory of all those killed in other genocides in other times. From the Holocaust to Cambodia to Rwanda to Bosnia. The lesson of the Holocaust is not that Jews are special. It is not that Jews are unique. It is not that Jews are eternal victims. The lesson of the Holocaust is that when you have the capacity to halt genocide, and you do not, no matter who carries out that genocide or who it is directed against, you are culpable. And we are very culpable. The F-16 fighter jets, the Apache attack helicopters, the 250-pound smart GBU-39 bombs are all part of the $3 billion military aid we give to Israel. But perhaps our callous indifference to human suffering is to be expected. We, after all, kill women and children on an even vaster scale in Iraq and Afghanistan. There will be more Palestinian children who die. There will be more UN schools used as a sanctuary by terrified families blown to bits by Israeli bombs, with more than 40 killed, half of whom were women and children. There will be more emaciated, orphaned children. There will be more screaming or comatose wounded in the corridors of Gaza's glutted hospital corridors. And there will be more Israeli lies. For that is what governments do in war. They distort and manipulate the facts, knowing that propaganda is a vital instrument in wartime. The shelling of the UN school in Jabalia took place, Israel said, because Hamas fighters had been firing mortars from near the school entrance. And they offered proof, an aerial photo which showed the school and the mortar. But the photo, it was uncovered, was more than a year old. It was a lie. And lies permeate the absurd reports like the one on the front page of this Sunday's New York Times titled, "A Gaza War Full of Traps and Trickery." In this story, unnamed Israeli intelligence officials gave us a spin on the war worthy of the White House fabrications made on the eve of the Iraq War. We learned about the perfidious and dirty tricks of Palestinian resistance fighters. Foreign reporters barred from Gaza and unable to check the veracity of the Israeli version of the war are asked to abandon their trade as reporters to become stenographers. The cynicism of conveying Israeli propaganda and lies as truth, as long as it is sourced to unidentified Israeli officials, is the poison of American journalism. If this is all journalism has become, if moral outrage, the courage to defy the powerful, the commitment to tell the truth and to give a voice to those who without us would have no voice, no longer matters, then our journalism schools should devote their energies to teaching shorthand. It seems to be the skill most ardently coveted by the majority of our senior editors and news producers. Gaza will be ruled in the future by antagonistic bands of warlords, clans, and mafias, resembling, I suspect, Somalia. And out of that power vacuum will rise a new generation of angry jihadists, many of whom may spurn Hamas for more radical organizations. Al-Qaeda, which has been working to gain a foothold in Gaza, may now have found its opening. Israel operates under the illusion that it can crush Hamas and install a quisling Palestinian government in Gaza and the West Bank. This puppet government will be led, Israel believes, by the discredited Palestinian Authority leader Mahmoud Abbas, now cowering in the West Bank after being driven out of Gaza. Abbas, like most of the corrupt Fatah leadership, is a detested figure. He is dismissed as the Marshal Pétain of the Palestinian people, or perhaps the Hamid Karzai or the Nouri al-Maliki. He is as loathed as he is powerless. Israel's destruction of Hamas and reoccupation of Gaza will not bring peace or security to Israel. It will merely obliterate the only internal organization with enough stature and authority in Gaza, an organization elected to power in free and fair elections to maintain order. The Israeli attack empowers the Islamic movements across the region, who one day may well wring Israel like a vice. The attack reduces all communication between the Palestinians and the Israelis to the language of force. The violence unleashed on Palestinian children will one day be the violence unleashed on Israeli children. This is the tragedy of Gaza, and this is the tragedy of Israel. 40-plus years after W.H. Auden described the dumb org loose on the streets of Prague, he lopes, still dumb, through the alleyways of Gaza City. The org does what orgs can, deeds quite impossible for man. But one prize is beyond his reach. The org cannot master speech. About a subjected plane, among its desperate and slain, the org stalks with hands on hips while drivel gushes from his lips. Thank you.
That was Chris Hedges speaking at Stop the Israeli Massacre in Gaza. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Over the last few weeks, we've been trying to keep people's attention focused on the humanitarian crisis as well as the military devastation of Gaza. Today, we're pleased to have with us Ebdin Jabara. He's a board member of the Center for Constitutional Rights, an attorney, as well as the former head of the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee. He's here to give us his perspective on Gaza. Ebdin, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
So, Ebdin, we wanted to talk to you today a little bit, to give us some perspective on how you see the assault on Gaza and what you see for the future. First, why don't you just give us your reaction to what you saw and read happening over the last few weeks?
Well, it's been horrendous. I mean, it's just absolutely horrendous. In my wildest dreams, I didn't think that they would pursue a policy so devastating as they did in Gaza. I mean, the attacks on the civilian infrastructure, civilian facilities, was unparalleled, I think, in all the things that Israel has done over the years. This is a new low for their military activity. I'm just reading now in the Financial Times what the devastation has been. There's been 4,100 houses that were destroyed, 17,000 damaged, 20 mosques destroyed.
Unbelievable.
25 education and health buildings, 31 security headquarters, 16 ministry buildings, 1,500 commercial facilities. It wasn't a war. It was basically an attack on the people of Gaza. And I think Rashid Khalidi hit the nail right on the head in an op-ed piece several weeks ago when he quoted Moshe Yalon, who said, an Israeli military official, who said in 2002, the Palestinians must be made to understand in the deepest recesses of their consciousness that they are a defeated people. That's what this attack on Gaza was all about. They have been able to, of course, split the frontline Arab states, get peace treaties with them through the Gaza Accords under the Carter administration, and then attack Lebanon in 1982, and the death and destruction that was rained upon that country drove the PLO out of Lebanon into Tunisia. Then there were all the machinations that led to the Oslo Accord, and then they split the Palestinian people. This is classic colonial activity.
I want to focus on what you started with here because, you know, when you read the physical destruction, of course, the killing of 1,400 Palestinians while only 13 Israelis are killed, the injuring of 5,000, the human cost, and when you read the New York Times, you know, I read it a couple of the last 2 days, and they talk about attacks on the police station, the university, the mosques. Nowhere do you see any real debate or even a statement that this is essentially a war crime. Not essentially, it's absolutely a war crime. And it's so shocking to me, Ebdin, that the world, yeah, the Times, everybody has just looked aside for 2 weeks now while Israel was essentially given a complete free hand to slaughter Palestinians and destroy the infrastructure. You know, and I saw the movie the other day, Waltzing with Bashir, the
right
story of the Sabra Shatila camps,
right,
and whatever way in which it held its punches, etc. In some way, there's a parallel. What really, although it was carried out in that case by the Falange, but you had people locked in a camp, and the world stood aside while, and Israel, of course, participated in letting the Falange in, while just people were slaughtered, and it's really unspeakable to me.
Well, I'm quite familiar with what happened in Sabra and Shatila. I was there very shortly thereafter and was able to get some children out to come for some treatment in the United States. That, as far as the impunity with which it was done and the silence in the West, I'm not so surprised about the United States and the New York Times, because they have pretty much given Israel carte blanche for years, that there has not been more of an outcry from the Europeans. The Czech president of the European Union was very supportive of the Israeli bombardment of Gaza. Now the Europeans, who are saying they want to help rebuild in Gaza, are adhering to Israel's demand that none of this aid go into Gaza that will in any way, shape, or form benefit Hamas. Well, this is ridiculous because, you know, the Hamas is still very much extant in Gaza, and how this so-called rebuilding is going to take place without dealing with the political reality on the ground there is beyond me.
Abdin, why do you think that is? Do you think it's the influence of United States policy that these countries aren't reacting in a more humane and...
I think that's it. You know, the Israelis moved now because they knew that Bush was a known quantity. They had lots of influence with him, and they were not sure about what would happen in the new administration. That's why they had this ceasefire, unilateral ceasefire, before the inauguration yesterday. And I think that the Europeans are basically trying to keep a low profile. Everybody's experiencing this enormous economic downturn, Europe as well as the United States, and they are very much tied into what the United States' plans are for reviving the Western economy. The thing is that very few people understand that Gaza is a large open-air concentration camp. It's just absolutely astounding. I mean, I went there back in the 1980s. 85% of the people in Gaza are either the original refugees or the descendants of refugees from Israel, when Israel was created in 1948. And Gaza was under the administration of the Egyptians, a very harsh administration, from 1948 until 1967, when the 67 war happened. And then when the Israelis took it over, they imposed a very harsh regime. They started to establish some settlements in Gaza, which they only took out in 2005. But it was still occupied. It was still hermetically sealed. The air, land, sea access to the country was completely controlled by Israel or its minions. Hamas, in these very pathetic missile they launched, this was essentially a jailbreak on the part of the people in Gaza, because they were being suffocated. There's over 50% unemployment in Gaza. The penury and the conditions of life there are untenable.
Abdin, go back to your first statement again. We've talked about some of the, you know, really the mass atrocities and the destruction of the civilian infrastructure. And you were talking about how what the Israelis have, I guess, arguably successfully done is been able to split the Palestinian movement.
Right.
And what do you see going forward from here? I mean, it is amazing. The world looked away. There's no question about it. It wasn't just, as you said, the Times and the U.S. government, but the world really looked away, other than Chavez, who, of course, expelled the Israeli ambassador, which was quite fabulous, and Bolivia apparently looking at a world court case of some sort.
Yes, they're fantastic. They could get elected in an Arab country. If
I think that's right. But how do you, what do you see now? I mean, what do you see strategically for the Palestinians? What do you see for progressive Americans who care about this?
Well, this is a very difficult issue because I think that these forces are only going to grow stronger. And, of course, this is very difficult for a lot of people on the left to relate to because, you know, they don't believe they're secularists and they believe in individual rights and so forth. And many of the things that they see as being not compatible with these religiously motivated movements. But these movements have been the last source of refuge for people who are struggling and are resisting. And that's what I see as happening. I think that this is going to grow. I think Hamas's popularity is going to grow. I think that the contradictions in that region, because let's talk about the splitting up of the Palestinians was preceded by the splitting up of all those countries in that area after the Second World War, the First World War. By the mandate system. They were created by the British and the French under the League of Nations. That was part of the divide and rule operation that has been going on since the end of the First World War after Turkey was defeated and the Ottoman Empire was broken up. Then it came down, and they want to divide it into different areas. The whole Iraq situation. They wanted the Shia and the Sunni to be fighting the exact same thing that they're doing in all of these countries. They want those people to be fighting among themselves rather than fighting against the real enemy, which is this Western imperialism and their agents, their principal agents in the area, which in this case is Israel. But so I see a much more pronounced, religiously motivated movement of resistance. And it's going to be difficult for many people on the left and progressives to somehow figure out how to relate to this. But it's important because this is going to exist whether or not the left takes a position or not. Obviously, I'll be very honest with you. I saw an interview with Bob Simon several weeks ago on Charlie Rose.
Who's Bob Simon?
He's with ABC News, and he was the correspondent, you know, that was captured briefly in Iraq and so forth. And he lived in Israel for 10 years. He said that there is no Israeli government and no U.S. government that has the political will to uproot the settlers in the occupied West Bank. He said there's not going to be a two-state solution. And I believe that. And I believe that the Israelis understand that. They have been stringing the Palestinians along about exchanging land and having two states, etc. But there's no seriousness in that. They had many opportunities to strike a deal with the nationalist forces, with Arafat and Fatah. They had many opportunities. And perhaps if chief architect of the Oslo Accords had not been assassinated, there could have been real progress. But I honestly don't see that happening now.
No, and particularly with the scenario you've painted, I mean, if you wanted a two-state solution, apart from, you know, what they've been suggesting as being essentially very, very poor two-state solution for the Palestinians, you have, what do? You have Hamas, you have Fatah. How do you, I mean, well, who do you talk to? And there's no one in Israel. As I agree with you, I think there's nobody as strong in Israel either.
And there's not going to be. They want to divide the Palestinians. They'll have Hamas stand in Gaza, cooped up, impoverished, denied any kind of access to any means to defend themselves. And the autonomous region, if you will, maybe in the West Bank, in areas that are too heavily populated, that so that they can get around the idea of giving them equal rights, continuing to have the military administration that they've had. This attack on Gaza and the way the ferocity and the desire to grind the Palestinians into the ground that this attack showed is going to lead to a lot of repercussions. We'll see them in places all over.
Obviously, the people behind this, to a large extent, are America, Americans, America, and American Jews. Do you have anything positive that you can tell people
they should be doing? I do have something, and I'd like to, you know, not many people have been willing to talk about Zionism in the United States. In other parts of the world, I think it has been a major issue. Zionism is alive and well. After the most recent attack on Gaza, they've been playing these Zionist songs and having all kinds of Zionist remembrances in Israel. A lot of people talk about Israel as being post-Zionist. It's not. It's still in the process of inculcating this idea of the ingathering of the exiles, and that they regard the Jews in other parts of the world as being in exile in Galut.
I don't know about you, but I certainly, I've talked to Palestinian friends. I have an absolute right of return to Israel.
Yeah.
Whereas my friends who were kicked out of their homes in Israel in 1948 and their children don't have that right. And
well,
so one thing we've thought of is giving up our right of return, which I don't think I'd ever really use, Abdin.
Abraham Foxman and Oren Radofsky and Brett Stevens from the Wall Street Journal are going to be speaking at a forum up at the 92nd Street Y entitled Why Zionism Has Become a Dirty Word.
Can't imagine why, Abdeen.
but I really think that we've got to talk about this. We've got to talk about what Zionism is. This is critical to this. If we don't talk about Zionism, people are not going to understand the roots of this problem. They just think it's this just happened, and there's this eternal conflict between the Arabs and the Jews.
The National Lawyers Guild, with your involvement over the past several decades, has sent several delegations to Gaza to observe human rights conditions and the document the types of weapons that Israel is using, funded by the United States. Are there plans for any immediate delegations in the next few months?
Well, I see some emails of people talking about it. One of the real problems is getting into Gaza. It would be wonderful if we could get into Gaza to see what is going on there. As you know, one guild member did go, Audrey Bomsey, but the last attempt to send a boat to Gaza from Cyprus in the Free Gaza effort, which the guild has endorsed, the boat was rammed by Israeli warships and had to return to Cyprus because it was damaged. The crossing at Rafah in Egypt does not allow for ingress into the Gaza. So I think what we have to do is we have to monitor the situation to see at what point we can get in there. But before we do that, we have to investigate what are the possibilities for legal redress, the bringing of lawsuits, the raising this matter in international legal fora. We have to investigate that so that we can be prepared to go there and get the information that we need to get to support those efforts.
You know, some of that's going on, as I know you follow closely, Abdeen. The efforts, though, that I'm sort of trying to figure it out, because I saw there was a huge set of groups, and possibly Bolivia, trying to get a case at the International Criminal Court.
Right.
And I was surprised only because the International Criminal Court doesn't really have jurisdiction in this case. So I didn't understand that, whereas on the other hand, Bolivia could conceivably bring a case against Israel in the International Court of Justice at The Hague. In some way, I think, on behalf of Palestinians, maybe, better than the ICC. But that's the kind of thing I think people ought to be doing. And I just noticed also today that Israel is no longer giving out the names of the brigade commanders who fought in Gaza, because they're afraid that those brigade commanders will be sued in courts throughout Europe, which, of course, is what should happen, not just brigade commanders, but obviously all of them. I mean, you just have to start nailing them. But, you know, it was really, I think, for me, the fact that the world looked aside, and you always think, you know, you think of the Holocaust when everybody says, and the world looked aside, and of course it wasn't on not this massive of scale, but it was essentially dropping bombs and killing, you know, over 1,400 people in a situation where there was no place to run and no place to hide. And the world really, really didn't do anything.
You know, Michael, I attended the oral argument in Mohammed versus Dichter last Friday.
I was out of town. I was anxious to go. So why don't you just mention that for a second? I'm interested in how it went. Why don't you tell people what the case is first?
Well, the case is where the Israeli military dropped a one-ton bomb on a civilian apartment building.
So a few years ago.
That killed 15 people and injured 50, all of whom were civilians. And the case is being brought under the Torture Convention and other international law regarding war crimes. And it's a civil case seeking damages for the victims.
Right, it's a Center for Constitutional Rights case.
And the center brought the case. They've been in the forefront of this type of work in this country, absolutely doing marvelous work. And what was so incredible was to be in that courtroom and to see those judges and to have this case come up for review, because it was lost in the trial court. On motions, and it was up there for review in the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, and to hear this argument and these questions coming from the judge with the background of what's going on in Gaza. It's just such a Kafkaesque, if you will.
I mean,
experience to be there in the courtroom. This was a case that arose several years ago, but it was being heard against the background of these bombs that are going off and killing all these people today.
And what it tells you is that had that case been won a few years ago, It might have sent a deterrence message to the Israeli government that you can't just drop one-ton bombs on civilian houses. But the problem is those cases are very difficult in our country.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
We really want to thank you for being with us, for giving us some amazing perspective on what I call the tragedy of Gaza right now.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Thank you.
Bye, Abdeen.
Bye-bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.